For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show, and we've had quite a week, and we'll have quite a few number of weeks in the next 4 years or so, as you might imagine, with the president that's totally a wild card and unpredictable, and always fantasizing about the conquest of friendly countries and beyond. I wanted to just update you on a couple of things before we go into the segment today, later on, which really, first of all, I want to say something about that. Today, I'm going to share with you the interview with Naomi Klein, who, for those of you who are not familiar with her work, she is she wrote, among other things, The Shock Doctrine. Her most recent book is Doppelganger, which I'm reading right now, which I haven't arrived at the crux of it like her other books. I've read her other books, starting with No Logo, where she predicted the Seattle uprising at the turn of the century. Basically, she predicted the anti-globalization movement, that there is something moving. For those of you who lived that period, you might remember that the mainstream press at the time, and this is relates to our historic moment now, the press at the time, the mainstream press, which was the only option for information at the time, said, basically painted the generation at the turn of the century, which was called Generation X. They basically X'd them out, meaning they painted them as these goths who are stagnant in every way, socially, politically, and are only interested in grunge rock and listening to Nirvana and that kind of culture, and that they're not going to amount to anything, and that they're just going to put up with the fact that their parents' generation did much better, and that they'll never do as well as their parents' generation because the cards are stacked against them. While in the meantime, here's Naomi Klein studying what's happening with American youth and with Canadian youth at that, and showing that they are bombarded with corporate advertisements and even bombarded with consumerist calls, basically, of things that they couldn't even consume because they couldn't afford it. But she predicted that there's some rumbling happening, and that eventually things, and she pointed to the fact that there's nothing, I don't have anything against goths, but they're not what they're being painted in the mainstream media. And it's, you know, like the Time magazine cover had shown the picture on the front of that Generation X as almost like this zombie-like group that is just incapable of moving anything in their lives. And lo and behold, they rose up in a big way. In fact, they rose up in such a big way that they inspired the environmental movement, they inspired the labor movement, they inspired the all progressive movements, and there were people from basically all walks of life that had united under class politics and their anti-capitalist politics, and that's where you saw them, in this big confrontation with the police. Also, we learned a lot about the role of the police, or at least the youth at the time learned at a at light speed of the role of the police, because see, the police was mobilized in the thousands to confront them, and it looked like a war zone. In fact, it was called the Battle in Seattle, if you remember. So this is who Naomi Klein is. And now, the book that she wrote on the shock doctrine was not is not a recent book. Her, as I mentioned, the recent book is Doppelganger, but the shock doctrine is a really important book if you haven't read it, and or if you or if you're looking for ways to fight back of what's happening right now, the attack on everything we have. It's a class struggle, basically. That's a one way w class war, basically, at this moment, because the Democrats are certainly not doing anything to confront beyond shouting and laughing and raising signs. And God bless the person that did stand up last night and interrupted Trump's speech. That was important. But in general, when they met the other day, they basically concluded, they had their little retreat, and they concluded with things that are preposterous, and that is summarized in the when they were given the opportunity to answer to this kind of State of the Union address, that if you want to call it that, that Trump delivered by saying by actually praising Stolkin, who was given the podium to basically answer to that kind of speech, saying that praising Ronald Reagan and indirectly by saying that if Trump was president at that time, that we wouldn't have won the Cold War. That's what they come up with. They haven't really come to terms that they really ushered in with their irresponsible behavior of not acknowledging whether it's the class politics, it's the, as they said back in the day of Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. They haven't acknowledged that there's a wealth gap. That's what they never addressed, the wealth gap that's growing. They never addressed the health the health insurance issues, the Medicaid, all these things that are being basically shredded right now were not addressed solidly. Instead, they dragged people like Cheney and such to talk about. They dragged the one percenters to represent them and say, "See, they're on our side," instead of addressing our issues. And of course, another factor, it's not the biggest factor, as some Democrats are blaming progressives, but of course, them not addressing this live genocide and really opening up the venue. For example, the attack on free speech today, in the past week, rather, the kind of attack on free speech, this declaration that colleges will lose federal funding if they have if they host students that are demonstrating, protesting illegally, and what is legal is determined by the monarch we call Trump. What's happening right now in terms of on the university is a complete terrorizing of students and threatening them with firings and such. Now, these administrations in higher education have already been doing this work. They've paved the way and eased the way and built the infrastructure and hired the kind of legal people to fulfill Trump's wildest dreams on college campuses back under Biden. And now he's just wielding those tools and pushing. And we're anybody that's in higher education is experiencing that. And God bless the students that are fighting the good fight in Colombia right now, literally like almost hand-to-hand combat right now at Hind Hall in Colombia University. The Democrats should take that example and carry it forward, but we're not going to get that. These parties, ever since Bill Clinton, have been in this incestuous relationship with each other. Back to the shock doctrine. All this to say about the shock doctrine. What we have here is the fact that, as Naomi Klein explains in the shock doctrine, is that we have the what's happening right now is a sh is the kind of shocking of America and the world, as we've witnessed in the past, just in the past week. What I mean by that is that the Trump administration is just attacking everything and making the most preposterous declarations and threats. And it's shocking the world. And what that allows them to do, a lot of people saying a lot of what he's saying is fantasy, yes, but it's effective. That's how Naomi Klein explains it, is that you get people in this kind of shock, and that allows you to dismantle things, and it disorients people, this kind of shock. It's like a blow to the head. That's what he's doing. It's psychological warfare to allow for the to allow him to change the material conditions that are that first of all, attacking Medicaid, attacking Social Security, attacking everything that helps the poor and the working class, and the kind of trade war and the threats to even friendly nations like Canada have actually made an impact on the stock market, where the stock market is taking a dive right now. Of course, the dive started under Biden, let's not forget that, but this is exasperating it further to ridiculous degrees. And that kind of shock allows people like that to smuggle their programs through where they intend to do so. So we do have people in the administration that are out and out fascist, and we do have people that are completely unpredictable and can switch on a dime. And that's what the shock doctrine about. So that's why it's really important. This interview in this interview and what Naomi Klein lays out in terms of what is happening now. It's the best explanation, not just of what's happening now, but it's the best explanation of, first of all, what climate change is going to do to the world and is doing to the world. We've just had ridiculous amount of fires, across the world, and in the south here we had like 175 wildfires that we haven't heard about, or rather fires. Maybe I shouldn't call them wild. That's kind of a shock too. Climate change is a shock, but as Naomi Klein explains in her book, those kinds of things. You have to think dialectically about, because if you just are shocked and feel disoriented and dizzy, you're not going to be able to do anything. But if you are alert and stay focused, and take care of yourself, and look at the openings, and most importantly, the key word is dialectical, is think dialectically about what are the opportunities that these shocks are opening up. And the examples she gives in, like, if a town is subjected to environmental damage, then that town can rebuild from scratch and leapfrog in terms of their planning for the future, meaning these old infrastructures weren't really weren't really built for the long term, and it allows for new opportunities to open up. So that's what dialectical thinking, and this is what this next segment is all about. So let's have a listen to Mehdi Hassan interviewing Naomi Klein on ZTU.
And it's all about shock and awe.
People are depleted and they're counting on this not waking people up.
He tried to freeze federal grants and funding. He said clean out Gaza of all its people.
Leading the World Health Organization, destroying healthcare in the United States, putting RFK Jr. in charge.
In his inauguration speech, he talked about manifest destiny to the stars.
This is what you do if you truly want to make it worse.
There was another Republican president who liked to shock and awe. He did it in Iraq in 2003.
I'm Naomi Klein.
And I'm Mehdi Hassan.
And this is Unshocked.
Naomi, welcome back. Good to see you again. Happy New Year, though there's not that much happy about it so far.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to see you because I feel like it's a very good time to get unshocked. Everyone's heads are exploding.
And this week we're going to get unshocked about shock.
Yes,
and because what we've seen since January 20th, we're recording this, what, 10 days, less than 10 days into the Trump presidency. And it's all about shock and awe. And before we get into the details of it, just for those of you watching at home who are old enough to remember, there was another Republican president who liked to shock and awe. He did it in Iraq in 2003.
The start of the campaign called Shock and Awe.
Artlist.io.
As many as 3,000 Tomahawk cruise missiles.
This isn't just an attack on bricks and mortar. It is an assault on the human senses.
This will not be a campaign of half measures. We will accept no outcome but victory.
Naomi, shock and awe is back in the news. It's not just the George Bush era. Everywhere we look now, people are talking about Donald Trump shocking and awing us. Mai Nai, a Columbia University professor, described the ICE raids as a form of shock and awe to terrorize immigrants. A reporter at the Washington Post, John Hudson, said that USAID officials are saying this is shock and awe, the way they're shutting down aid to the entire world, with the exception of Israel. Even Steve Bannon, the guy who first talked about shock and awe in the first term, he's saying this has gone beyond shock and awe. He's calling this the days of thunder. You wrote a book called The Shock Doctrine, which is where the name of this show comes from, Unshocked. What are they doing when they're trying to shock us?
Yeah, so that the military strategy, the shock and awe military strategy from 2003, the invasion of Iraq, the whole approach was designed to overwhelm and awe Iraqis so that they would just kind of lie down and give up. That was the military strategy. If we recall, it didn't actually pan out that way.
No.
There was a short-term sort of suspended animation. Then there was a lot of looting and chaos. And then there was a very, very intense response that bogged the US down. So it's a bad strategy. I don't know why they're trying it again, but the idea is to come at you from all directions, right? And the shock approach has also been used in economics. The idea that you want to apply shock therapy to a population so that they essentially give up, right? And so a big part of this, I think describing the raids as a shock and awe approach, what that speaks to is not just that there's a lot of it happening all at once, but that it is being performed, right? That's why, you know, Dr. Phil goes along, and that's why there's like media embeds, is that they're counting on this being broadcast to communities overwhelm them, have a sense of futility because there's so much coming at us. And that's the flurry of executive orders as well, which I know you had your eye on. We're not supposed to be able to keep track as journalists.
And you used the word overwhelmed. And interestingly, to go back to Steve Bannon, a man you and I have studied, sadly, have had to study. I know you, when you wrote your book, you spent a lot of time listening to The War Room. He's the guy who famously in the first term said to Michael Lewis of Bloomberg, the Democrats don't matter. The real opposition is the media. And the way to deal with them is to flood the zone with shit. And that's where we get this phrase of them flooding the zone. But this time around, he said recently in a Washington Post interview, they're not just, he said, they're overwhelming the system. And he says that in a positive way. When you talk about overwhelming people and flooding the zone, it is about numbing us. It is about making the public not be able to keep up, journalists not be able to keep up. They've done so much. You mentioned executive orders. I just, again, for our viewers who may not be able to follow all this, just to give a sense, Naomi, while we get this conversation going about shock and awe, just some of the things that Donald Trump has done in 10 days, just a few. I just want to run through them very fast. He pardoned January 6th insurrectionists. He pulled America out of the climate change agreement, the Paris Agreement again. He signed a bunch of executive orders trying to end asylum at the southern border, trying to end DEI in government, trying to end birthright citizenship. He said ICE can grab people from churches. He called for MSNBC to lose their broadcasting license. He fired DOJ people. He fired NLRB people. He illegally fired 18 inspectors general from the federal government. He tried to freeze federal grants and funding. He said clean out Gaza of all its people. He sent 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. He threatened Denmark. He threatened Colombia. He threatened Panama. He renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. He told Mark Milley.
It's a lot.
I could keep going, but there's a lot.
You could keep going, and we'd be here all day.
But that really does overwhelm the media, the Democrats, the public. Where do you focus your attention when you're being shocked and awed like that?
Well, this is the whole idea for Unshocked, which is we have to pick out the signal from the noise. And that's part of understanding that this is a strategy. It's designed to make you curl up in a ball and give up. It's also designed to make you do their work for them, right? So I think part of what we're seeing is, an executive order that is patently illegal, or many of them, right?
Yes.
But, to talk about a recent one, the appropriation of funds that were allocated under the last government. They have no right to do that. They know they have no right to do that. But what they successfully did is scare the hell out of people, right? I mean, this is not just about overwhelming the senses. It's about fear, right? This is the other thing Bannon is talking about right now, is he's talking about peace through strength, right? So they're doing a few things to just show that they're willing to do anything. Right. And sending these messages of you could be next. Right. And so when it seems like they're going to freeze everybody's funding and take everybody's funding, if they are while they hunt for gender ideology and Green New Deal
indoctrination, Marxists.
Nobody comes to work saying, today I'm going to do gender ideology and today we're going to implement the Green New Deal. There is no Green New Deal. It didn't get passed. Joe Biden didn't even get Build Back Better through, let alone the Green New Deal. So the point is to make everybody at a foundation, everybody at a university, everybody in the nonprofit sector look at what they're doing through the eyes of the Trump administration and think about, okay, well, who can we throw under the bus, right? Yeah. Who can we sacrifice? So they're sending that fear through every institution. And of course, with the shock and awe immigration raids, it is a very, very tangible fear. And that's why it's really significant when you have countries standing up like Colombia, and saying this is, you can't treat our people this way, it messes with the script.
Yeah, and you had a couple of judges so far stand up to him, one on the birthright citizenship executive order saying it's blatantly unconstitutional. And then this judge, Muslim judge, which must have annoyed them even more, who halted their their federal funding freeze. And they now claim to have done a U-turn or a rescission. We will wait and see on that. But this idea that we are limited in what we can do. You make a very good point that they want us to do their work for them. And just another quote that I just spotted.
Journalists,
activists, before the election, in fact, just before the inauguration, The New York Times ran a piece about Stephen Miller profiling another Bannonite in the government, another one of these kind of revolutionaries. And the Times said, Mr. Miller appears to have learned two key lessons from the first Trump term. The first is to flood the zone. He believes that those he regards as Mr. Trump's enemies, Democrats, the media, groups like the ACLU, are depleted and only have so much bandwidth for outrage and opposition. Mr. Miller has told people that the goal is to overwhelm them with a blitz of activity. Do you think they're succeeding 10 days in?
I think he's not wrong that people are depleted. I think coming out of this election, people are depleted. Coming out of the pandemic, people are depleted. And they're counting on this not waking people up. But I would argue that this is actually a really risky strategy. Because he's right that people's tanks are pretty low, but I think people can also be pushed too far, and you can wake people up. Shock can be a bit of a jolt, right? Like it's they're playing with fire a little bit, right? They're hoping that the shock just overwhelms people and makes people lie down and give up. There's also a history of overwhelming shock inspiring people to fight, and that could happen too. I think the other thing that we, if we're picking out the signal from the noise here, what Miller is doing, you know, he's their sadism guy. You know, he's really important to this project because he is the one who is just kind of serving up blood to the base, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's why they want
the cruelty
that.
Is the point.
The cruelty is the point, but it's not just the point. The point is also distraction, right? Because
yep.
Trump did not run on having. The big tech billionaires be his favorite people in the world, who he showers $500 billion for AI, which it turns out the whole business model was failing anyway, right? I mean, he's actually doing the exact opposite of what somebody like Steve Bannon has been telling his listeners for years, which is that they were going to take on big tech,
yeah.
Right? The biggest economic initiative so far is handing this over to, $500 billion for AI, huge corporate welfare, right? So he needs to distract his base, because while he's feeding,
yes.
the billionaires these lavish subsidies, the base needs something. And what the base is getting is this sadism.
When you mentioned the distraction, it just reminds me of all Republican presidents, right? All Republican presidents used culture wars or some distraction from what they were essentially doing, which was to transfer wealth from the poor to the rich, to give tax cuts, all the things we know Trump has done and wants to do again. And yes, his base were not supposed to be fans of H-1B visas or tech billionaires and all of the rest of stuff. What's interesting is journalists give him cover, Naomi. Amy Walter, who is your classic Beltway pundit, said on Twitter last week, I don't think it's correct to call Trump 2.0 shock and awe. He's doing exactly what he said he would on the campaign. That's just not true. He didn't say on the campaign that he's going to spend his first week in office picking a war with Denmark over Greenland. He was supposed to be reducing the price of eggs, not trying to annex new territory. And when he talks about stuff like manifest destiny in his inauguration speech, I never heard that phrase on the campaign trail. I never heard him say that they're going to try and conquer more territory for the United States. This is all pretty new, and it is shocking. What do you think is going on there when you get all this new kind of empire stuff from Trump?
Well, I think there's a bunch of different interests who are fighting over the pot at the moment. But it is true, and we need to focus in on the things that are very different from what people thought they were voting for. Like ending wars, and he's picking all kinds of, but we knew this was going to happen minimally with China, but yep. I've been really interested listening to MAGA media that they're sort of preparing the audience for an escalation with Iran, for like, I heard Bannon this morning talking about picking a fight with Qatar. Like, I mean, what exactly are they doing? The big picture that I think is happening, and this is where it's different. I've covered what I call the shock doctrine for a long time. In recent decades, I think there's two things that are different when it comes to Trump, and he's not the first person to do it, but I think it's just really an escalation, is he isn't waiting for another shock to exploit. He's creating the shocks. That's what the days of thunder are. They are a rolling sense of shock, right? So, Bush had 9/11, right? I mean, he actually had a bolt from the blue, and
that's a good point.
And Trump is not waiting. not to say that he...
He's declared an emergency at the southern border. There is no emergency. Exactly. The numbers crossing are lower than when he left office, but he's just created an emergency.
He's declared an energy emergency, right? The fact is there are real emergencies. There's a climate emergency. Second largest city in the United States, large parts of it still smoldering. And in the face of that, he's declaring an energy emergency, which is permission to accelerate extraction, i.e. the very thing that is driving the climate crisis. So you make the real crisis worse while declaring a fake emergency. You deny the real emergency. And so what is that about, right? And I think that points to the other thing that is different about Trump. Most of the people who I've covered who use this tactic, including to a large extent, the second Bush administration, they mainly used it for, they did use it for expansion, but they mainly used it to push neoliberal economics, it's a free for all, privatization, deregulation. They definitely had geopolitical goals, but Trump is of another order. Like, he's bringing back a kind of a He-Man conservatism from like the pre-Paleolithic age. I mean, it is about asserting.
Oh, Naomi, I was a fan of He-Man growing up. You just ruined him for me forever.
But it really is like zooming out. It's yes, it is all those things around corporate giveaways. So we can't take our eye off that. But it is also this return of just the crassest kind of dominance, right? Men over women.
Yep.
Straight over gay, dad over the family, America over the world, rich over everybody else. And it's really, and I think this speaks to the appeal of Trump, right, is that he is from the quote unquote woke era, but he's even pre-1990s political correctness. Like, he's from the 80s. He's a creature of the 80s. Yeah. Before anybody had to do anything to, to mediate what it means to be powerful, right? Like, if you've got money and you've got power.
Gordon Gekko without the charm or brains.
And I think what we underestimated, many of us, is the extent to which it pained these billionaires to have to make even the most minor concessions, right? We saw a lot of this come out around Palestine and the genocide, and using that issue to take aim at all of the gains in recent decades. Many of the gains were very limited. I mean, that's the irony, is that we've ended up with, sometimes very cosmetic changes, sort of centrist identity politics that lifted up a few people, but actually allowed life to get worse for most people of color, for instance, and women. And that is part of the demoralization, frankly, that Miller is speaking to. It's not just, okay, the Democrats had a bad election. I think that the left is very divided over what centrism has delivered, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to come back to centrism in a moment, just sticking with what you mentioned earlier, the climate crisis, and what I mentioned earlier, manifest destiny. I wonder if there is a collision or even a kind of correlation between these two, because in his inauguration speech, he talked about a manifest destiny to the stars, right? And Steve Bannon has talked about a manifest destiny 2.0, referring to this apparent desire to annex Greenland and Canada and Panama Canal. And I just wonder, is this sense of screw the rest of you, screw egg prices, screw climate change, screw wildfires, screw inequality. We, our select few, have much higher aspirations to conquer the planet, conquer the stars. Like, have we gone back? He mentioned William McKinley. Like, we've gone back 100 years?
Well, in a way, I think it's all he has to offer, right? This sort of mythic superiority, precisely because he isn't going to deliver on those material benefits that he promised. But there is something, and this is something that I think that we can often underestimate, that there are real pleasures in offering people being part of the best country in the world, the country that is able to dominate others, being part of the group in that country that is most protected, that is most loved. Is what he is able to offer. I mean, he's not going to be lowering the price of eggs, not threatening tariffs on everybody. I mean, he's actually going to cause prices to soar with his policies, and he'll blame everybody else. But But we should not underestimate the power of these mythical stories. I mean, they've worked in the past, and I think that they're I think it's precisely because of those other real emergencies that I was referencing earlier that they can't. Things are getting worse because the crises are real. Whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's the fact that our economy is just a precariousness machine and people are having to work harder and harder. So what can he offer, right? And he can offer this sort of being part of strength. And that's what, you know, I think it's sad because for the billionaires who he's really serving, they really are protected. You know, their wealth really does protect them. And, you know, this is what we're seeing when we see how angry they were for having to open a DEI HR office, you know, or having to like, put pronoun, yeah. Like allow their workers to use their preferred pronouns or whatever minor concession they had to make. It every one of them pained them so much because they truly believe, I think, that their wealth means that they get to play by another set of rules. And Trump is offering them that. And so, you know, when
They also get to pretend to be victims, Naomi. There was a great moment in the inauguration where Trump talked, and I think he went off script. I don't know if this was in the actual speech, when he talked about the wildfires. And then he goes, some people are in this room, rich people, and they lost their homes too. And it's like, no, they didn't. Bezos did not lose his home. Zuckerberg did not lose their home. What are you talking about? And A, if they had lost their homes, who cares? Thousands of people lost their homes. Why should we care about billionaires losing their homes? But it goes back to your point about being protected. This idea that they have been able to erect castles and moats and just, you know, cut themselves off as much as possible. But even with climate change, no one is really immune, not even the richest people in the world. So now you've got this idea of like everyone wanting to go into space. It's no coincidence, is it, Naomi, that Bezos and Musk and Thiel and all these people are obsessed with creating, you know, new frontiers and new civilizations and, you know, Star Trek style, going where no person has gone before. That feels not coincidental. That feels partly ideological.
It's ideological, and it's also... there's, you know, even though it sort of presents as being idealistic and like, you know, this is a new dream, it's actually incredibly pessimistic. Like if you dig into what's, you know, the Silicon Valley ideology, this thing called long-termism, right? They've already written off Earth. You know, when Jeff Bezos came back from space, he was like, well, this is a good, he actually said, this is a good place to put our garbage, you know, like he's like, we're running out of space on Earth so we can throw our garbage into space. So, you know, I think that that Musk, you know, he used to be a green energy guy, right? He used to be very focused on the climate crisis. Now he doesn't talk about it because he's already given up, right? And, and you know, I personally believe that Trump knows that the climate crisis is real. He sort of has to because Mar-a-Lago is very vulnerable. But as you say, they're all going to be fine. And they've all calculated that they're going to be fine. And of course, Thiel is like the original billionaire prepper. You know, he's got land in New Zealand. So in a way, I think space is, it's really just a kind of clunky metaphor for what they're doing down here, which is building their escape hatches. And, you know, they really think that they're going to be okay and that it's going to be other people who are not. You know, and this is, I think,
And everything can burn down, right? It doesn't matter if stuff burns down because... it's either not going to affect them in the short term or the long term. And when I say burn down by the name, Naomi, we're not just talking about like fires burning down forests. Bannon style, they want to destroy the government. When Musk is saying, hey, guys, we take a buyout or whatever phrase you want to use, not a buyout, but leave the government, which is what they're offering this week. Get rid of federal government employees. That is all part of me thinks that they think even if we can't get away with it fully, even if we only partly dismantle the government, when the Democrats come back, they're not going to have the guts to rebuild it or rehire the people we've gotten rid of. They will have moved that Overton window in such a way that the damage will be done. And again, they don't care what happens in the long run because as you say, they've written off the planet, they've written off society, they're all about their bottom line. And I just wonder, you've written about the shock doctrine in the context of neoliberalism and, you know, shock therapy, privatization. You've written about it in the context of the Iraq war. In this context, when we talk about the shock doctrine being employed here, is it just this idea, I wonder, to smash stuff, break stuff as much as you can in whatever limited time
stuff.
You have on the grab stuff on the way out. And also the assumption ideologically that the next bunch, even if the Democrats win back the House and Senate in 26, or even if they win back the presidency in 28, they're not going to be able to rebuild what we've broken.
I think that's part of it. And I think there's a really deep libertarian streak at work, whether or not that's true of Trump personally. I mean, it's always strange to talk about what he thinks. You know, he has, it's just a series of grudges, you know, and appetites.
Impulses.
Yeah. But somebody like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, I mean, I think the appeal of crypto for them is that it is a currency that doesn't rely on the nation state, right? I mean, they're obsessed with this idea of kind of secession from Earth, even without outer space, right? But space is part of that narrative. They are preparing, and yeah, I mean, they're wrecking to not be able to rebuild, absolutely. But where this gets really tricky is nationalism is the dead center of the MAGA project for the base, right? This is what's very clear. Like believing in the nation and its borders is the animating idea, right?
Although it's very inconsistent, because suddenly Donald Trump wants to expand America's borders. He said recently, there's no reason Canada should be part of our country because of one man-made border. I'm like, hold on, you sound like a globalist now. Suddenly open borders, let's change America's borders. But you're right. Nationalism is what they claim is what drives them. You actually
and nationalism
mentioned to me recently,
and border and colonialism, which is what Trump
yes,
is doing,
and keeping
are totally
and keeping
compatible.
Undesirables
yes,
out.
Absolutely,
keeping undesirables out. Yeah. As we saw with Musk, he's fine with bringing people he needs for his companies. But you mentioned a book which I haven't read by Richard Seymour recently, which unpacks some of this. And there was a phrase that caught my mind: disaster nationalism, not just nationalism, but disaster nationalism.
Right. I mean, because what Seymour is getting at is the fact that we are in an age of serial disasters of many kinds, you know, military, economic, ecological. And it's precisely because, like, even if it's subconscious, we know that this project is in crisis. It's falling apart. It's not able, and this is a point that Seymour makes, is like, you know, the old school fascists actually could offer something like a good life to the people who followed them. And there isn't even really that hope within MAGA. You know, they say, oh, you're going to be able to afford a home. And, you know, they're not offering people a sustainable life. I mean, they're off. It's more like a suicidal drive, right? And this is where, you know, frankly, the only way that I can make sense of it is really thinking about the role of these biblical narratives, these deeply encoded biblical narratives about the rapture and the end times and how that plays out. And I do think that for some of Trump's hardcore religious followers, they really do believe, and this is why they're very interested in Israel and Palestine, is like, that's a key plot point in the story of like, you bring on the return of, you know, the savior, you know, and it has to be there, and it has to be the Israelites who return. And so that entangles us in all kinds of things you and I have talked about before, building the third temple. And then you think about Hegseth and his tattoo, and you think about Huckabee and all these Christian Zionists. So that there's that part
but
of
it's a weird alliance though,
it's
isn't
a weird
it?
Alliance,
it's an alliance between the kind of secular tech fundamentalists, the biblical Christian evangelical fundamentalists, and then at the center of it all is Donald Trump, who, as we say, believes nothing other than getting ahead in the short term and making money for him and his family. And it's that weird alliance of fundamentalists, but from different walks of life.
Yeah, and both are okay with letting it burn, and both are sort of waiting for their sort of golden castle. Some of them believe it's in the sky after you die. Some of them believe it's in New Zealand, you know,
or on Mars. Mars. Yeah.
But this is where I think maybe we can understand, like, why do they need so much money? Why do they need more money? I mean, they truly are preppers, right? I mean, they have the mentality of real hoarders. They just don't hoard canned goods like normal people, you know.
They hoard rocket ships.
We should all rewatch Don't Look Up, by the way, because they do.
Yes. You know, it's very, very true. And the billionaire in that was very much based on our and the guy who's now running the country. Let me ask you this. You mentioned earlier this idea of the myth, which is what drives a lot of these people. Trump is offering a myth. And we know that his voters kind of know deep down they're not going to get cheaper eggs, but they're going to get to own the libs. Mm-hmm. They're going to get to stop brown people crossing the border. They're going to get their country back in some intangible, reactionary way. Yeah. What is the response to that then? From progressives, from liberals, from leftists? Do we need a myth of our own, a national story of our own? And if so, are Democrats up for producing such a story?
Let's leave the Democrats aside for a while. I mean, I think they want to be left to one side. I think about, and I don't think that, you know, that Seymour's point in disaster nationalism is this is a global project. I mean, this is the other thing we're seeing is the emboldening of people like Giorgia Meloni and other people who have been, you know, part of this network and project, but now they feel like they can really show who they are. So I think the response can't only be national. I think the response is international. I mean, what I see is, if these people all have a plan B or a planet B, right? I mean, if they are all planning to abandon this place, I think we should understand them. I think they're traitors to this world. I think they are treasonous to this world. And if we try to understand what it means to, you know, look at Los Angeles burning and say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to literally pour fuel on this with more fossil fuel contracts, destroy FEMA. You know, Donald Trump, who lost power because of his murderous mismanagement of the last pandemic, responds by leaving the World Health Organization, destroying healthcare in the United States, putting RFK Jr. in charge. I mean, we'll see. But like, this is what you do if you truly want to make it worse. And I think we should take them at their word. And I think we should say, you all have a plan to leave in one way or another, and we need to be committed to staying and in all that that represents. And I think we need to find our anger at what it means to truly be treasonous to this world. I've been watching the show Traitors, by the way, it's really good. But on Traitors,
is it a fictional show?
Oh my goodness, Mandy. Everyone is laughing at you right now. I haven't seen it. It's a reality show. And it's like a hit reality show. It's the only reality show that I've ever gotten into.
I can't believe I'm having a conversation with Naomi Klein where she's laughing at me for not watching a reality show.
You should watch it. I watch it with my son. He loves it. And you've got your traitors and you've got your faithful, the people who and that is, I think we need that sort of mythic storytelling where, you know, this is why I say it's not about the Democrats.
We'll come back to the Democrats because we do need to talk about the Democrats. But just on the left, Naomi, then, even the left more broadly, does the left have the ability to produce that narrative? Because even when I see prominent leftists, both American and international, talk about, you know, what to stand for, it's often universal health care, Medicare for all. These are great policies and popular if you look at the polls, but it's not a narrative. Yeah. It's not a story.
And I think we do have to find that real prophetic voice. And I think that we catch glimpses of it when people are really committing to each other in this moment and really protecting each other. Because that's when people are acting in ways that are larger than themselves. And, you know, when we talk about the way the right is marshaling the power of myth and tapping into these apocalyptic, deeply encoded stories, whether it's a religious version of it or whether it's the secular version of it, these are deeply mythic stories. And I think when people take risks and talk about how we're bound up together and what we owe each other and what we owe the natural world, I think we're starting to find that sort of story that can bind us together. And we can prove Stephen Miller wrong and sort of be less depleted because we're attacking each other less divided. I think we find strength when we come together, not to be too hokey. I mean, you sound hokey when you talk about it, but, you know, I think there's ways of doing it.
But it is, to be even more hokey, it is up to us, right? Mm. There's no one coming to rescue us. As you say, certainly not the Democratic Party, which is, it's a two-party system. So if you're going to stop the Republicans, it has to be done with the Democrats. And yet the Democrats are AWOL at the moment. They themselves are saying this. I've seen Politico and The Post and Time Magazine quoting multiple senators saying, give us some time. We need a bit more time. We're not quite sure what the strategy is. We're not quite sure what the message is. In fact, Time Magazine had this great piece about a week ago in which they quoted a Democratic strategist called Jesse Ferguson saying, you can write a eulogy before someone dies. You cannot write an autopsy until the body is on the table. In other words, the version of the Democratic Party that got killed in 2024 is still twitching. And this idea that the Democrats really, A, haven't understood why they lost, which is one thing, but also this idea of how do you deal with Trump 2.0? They barely defeated Trump 1.0 thanks to the pandemic. He probably would have won in 2020 without the pandemic. And now you've got Trump 2.0. Again, he squeaked in without winning the majority of the vote. He won the popular vote, but not the majority. And yet, to go back to it, where are the Democrats saying, this is what we stand for, this is who we are? That just doesn't exist right now. And we're already, as I say, 10 weeks into chaos and shock and awe.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I think the Democrats and the other sort of so-called centrist neoliberal parties the world over have brought us to this moment. It is the failures, decades of failures, of betraying their own base, of allowing these astronomical levels of inequality, more and more precarity in people's lives, and just kind of the legalized corruption that breeds all the cynicism that creates the opening for these strong men to come in. And, you know, I was saying earlier about, I think we underestimated how much they hated every single tiny little cosmetic concession they had to make. They hated it. And what we're seeing in this sort of the dead-eyed determination and the sadism of this moment is a counter-revolution. It's a counter-revolution. But Mehdi, we never had the revolution, right? We're getting a counter-revolution without the revolution that would have actually made people's lives better. And the problem is that means there's no one at the barricades to defend the DEI office. Because actually people will defend universal health care, but they're not going to defend these policies.
That's so true.
And so they got us here.
You said earlier in the show about the Green New Deal. It's kind of like the same thing you mentioned, you know, Marxism. First of all, I've lived in D.C. for a decade. I've never met a single Marxist in Capitol Hill, White House, or anywhere near the levers of government, sadly. But this idea that you make a very good point, that people are not going to go to the ramparts for things that they weren't that happy to begin with, right? It was a compromise to begin with.
It didn't make their lives better.
It was Obamacare. Yeah, or it made their lives a little bit better, but not in an obvious way. Obamacare did make lots of people's lives better, but it didn't transform the American healthcare system in the way that we all know it needed to be transformed. And we've seen the reaction to the Luigi and co. So you're right. It's such a good point that they are fighting a battle that's easy for them to win because there are no defenders on the other side. The counter-revolution has the advantage.
I mean, look, this is what neoliberal centrism has delivered. A counter-revolution that is very serious without the revolution that would have united us, right? And so that's, I think, what we need to be thinking very strongly about how we don't make those mistakes again, how we give people something to actually fight for, that they would defend.
So we need it. So what you're saying, Naomi, is we need a counter revolution against a revolution that never happened. Put that on a message. Put that on a bumper sticker. One Democrat. Before we wrap up, I got to say one Democrat who has been making a lot of noise recently, to the point where a lot of liberals are saying she seems to be the voice of the party right now, not in ideological terms, but in terms of just fighting the good fight and taking a stand, is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman AOC, who's taken a lot of heat from right-wingers over the years and from some on the left who see her as not left enough. I just want to play one clip from a recent interview she did with Jon Stewart on his podcast.
One of the problems is that the internal incentives within the Democratic Party are quite contrary to a clear, full-throated agenda. And that's why I think you notice, like, Biden on his way out, it was only on his way out that he was like, this country's controlled by oligarchs. Bye. Like, we could have used that energy a couple years ago.
Naomi, we could have used that energy a couple of years ago. She says, we could use that energy a couple of hours ago when I look at the current Democratic Party.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there are some people who are bringing some of that energy. Zohran Mamdani, running for mayor of New York City, I think is showing that that you can have populist policies from the left that inspire people and direct the anger in the right direction. I don't think that this is just about anger, by the way. I think it's a combination of anger at the people who are destroying lives, families, the planet.
Mehdi Hassan interviewing Naomi Klein and talking about the really important subject, especially for those of you who are activists and who want to do something, who feel bludgeoned and disoriented right now. I think it's a really important book to read these days in order to get our bearing and figure out some firm ground that we can stand, ideological ground that we can stand on, and how we can defend. And the most important thing, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is to think dialectically, that to focus, that once there, for any attack that happens, there's an opening. For any punch, there's an opening to the body, basically, of this madness that we're experiencing. We'll see you next week, or we'll rather, we'll talk to you next week on Wednesday from 2 to 3, as we always do, on the Shai of Nana show. This is Zain El Amin signing off.
And find, you know, more productive ways to talk to each other. So in some ways, to end on a positive note, we should be grateful to our oligarchs.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for change makers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information are available at www.diversityfund.org. You can send questions to info@diversityfund.org. Upcoming info session dates and recordings are accessible online at www.diversityfund.org. The phone number for further information is 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 5th. Here are some headlines. A sharply divided Supreme Court today reinstated a lower court order for the Trump administration to release frozen foreign aid, but it was not clear how quickly the money would start flowing. The Trump administration had appealed U.S. District Judge Amir Ali's deadline to give the federal government until February 26 to pay out $2 billion in aid. The federal government froze foreign aid after an executive order from Trump targeting what he called wasteful programs that do not correspond to his foreign policy goals. The spending freeze has had a devastating impact on even the most urgent life-saving programs around the world. The court's action leaves in place Justice Ali's temporary restraining order that had paused the spending freeze. Justice Ali is holding a hearing tomorrow to consider a more lasting pause. In other news, President Donald Trump delivered a combative campaign-style address before Congress and the American public last night. In the nearly 100-minute speech, Trump bragged about his divisive executive actions and repeated false accusations that drew protests from Democratic lawmakers. He claimed his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, had already found hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud, though his administration has provided no evidence of that. Trump also blamed former President Joe Biden for everything from higher grocery prices to foreign conflicts. Immigration was also a key focus, with Trump stressing crimes allegedly committed by undocumented immigrants and calling for stricter border security. In more news, the U.S. will continue to suspend weapon supplies and intelligence sharing with Ukraine until a date for peace talks with Russia is set, White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said today. The U.S. decision to pause military aid is increasing pressure on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to agree to move ahead with negotiations with Russia to end the war. The pause is unlikely to lead to a sudden collapse of Ukraine's defensive lines, but it could particularly undermine air defenses and precision strike capabilities. Trump's decision to enforce the pause followed an extraordinary clash with President Zelensky last week. And the U.S. and Israel have rejected an Arab plan for the post-war reconstruction of the Gaza Strip that would allow the 2.1 million Palestinians living there to stay in place. The proposal, endorsed by Arab leaders at a summit in Cairo, is their alternative to President Trump's idea for the U.S. to take over Gaza and permanently resettle its population. The Palestinian Authority and Hamas welcomed the Arab plan, which calls for Gaza to be governed temporarily by a committee of independent experts and for international peacekeepers to be deployed there. But both the White House and Israeli Foreign Ministry said it failed to address realities in Gaza and stood by Trump's plan. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 57 degrees under rainy skies,